From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
As you all know, a few months ago that I filed the petition to convene the Special Investigation Committee against Speaker Madigan. Representative Welch, who's the chairman of the committee's recent decision this week to postpone the Special Investigating Committee's work, leads to one conclusion. He took a dive for Mike Madigan. Chairman Welch tried to claim that our intentions were political, which is quite frankly insulting. The only thing that is political is Representative Welch's covering up of the corruption in his own party before an election.
That's the House Republican leader Jim Durkin after news that the House Special Investigative Committee looking into Speaker Madigan won't have more meetings anytime soon, and even then, it doesn't appear there would be much action. And the fight over the graduated income tax amendment heats up more. We'll talk about that and some other issues coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. Our panel is practicing social distancing once again from his home. We have Charlie Wheeler, an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie is also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, Hannah Meisel, a reporter covering state government and politics for NPR Illinois. And joining us on the show today, we have A.D. Quigg, a reporter for Crane Chicago Business. And A.D., thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's start with that Madigan committee and get the latest on that. Republicans pushed to have it formed and to look into Madigan dealings involving Commonwealth Edison. And you may recall Madigan was singled out in a deferred prosecution agreement with federal prosecutors as ComEd says it provided jobs and contracts to Madigan associates in exchange for help with legislation that benefited the company. Madigan has not been charged. He says he's done nothing wrong. He's called the committee a political stunt. But Republicans still wanted him to be subpoenaed and to show up. So, Hannah, what is the latest on this committee? Are we going to see any more action from it?
Not at least until after the election. The chairman, Chris Welch, which you could hear Leader Durkin talking about in that intro there, he announced, I believe it was Tuesday, that the committee would cease, you know, any more hearings until November 5th. Which is, of course, 2 days after the election, and Republicans went apoplectic. They were pretty upset by that. Although I have to say, you know, they shouldn't be surprised by this development. I had asked last week after the hearings, I mean, first of all, if there's no one else who's willing to come forward, everyone else has either ignored or said no in the case of Speaker Madigan to invites, and there is no, if no one's going to be subpoenaed, then there's really not much to do than like, okay, are you going to go to Springfield and just twiddle your thumbs and, you know, argue about some more very technical stuff and not lead to anything? I mean, if the speaker is subpoenaed, which I don't think will happen, but I mean, then he'd just come to Springfield and plead the fifth. I mean, Leader Durkin said as much yesterday during a press conference. And so, I mean, the Republicans have kind of played all of their cards here. And, Leader Durkin was, upset at the suggestion that it was a political stunt. But I mean, they also have the right to be very upset at what was in that deferred prosecution agreement. I mean, we've already had a public official A here in Illinois, and it was ex-Governor Rod Blagojevich, and things didn't end well. And now Speaker Madigan is another public official A. Of course, they have the right to be angry about, undue political influence and just the fact that they, by Madigan's house rules, by his allies. I mean, the Republicans especially, they've become a super minority party and they have almost no power. And the only thing that they can do is call press conferences and lob bombs. Like, it can be both, that you can be upset by those political ramifications and you can also be genuinely upset by the ramifications for public policy.
Yeah, of course there's politics here, Charlie, and we've talked about this before, about, a federal investigation is ongoing. Oftentimes lawmakers, when they're looking into this type of activity, they don't want to step on the toes of the federal prosecution. I'm still unclear on exactly whether or not the federal prosecutors say you can go forward with your investigation in the House or maybe you shouldn't go forward with it. But in the end of the day, it is a serious matter. And despite the politics and all of that, there does need to be more information come forth. And I think the governor's even said that.
Yeah, the governor has said that he has encouraged Madigan, urged Madigan to appear and answer these questions. But whether or not Madigan's going to do it, I would guess not, because my guess is that Representative Durkin can say, oh, this is not political, but that's kind of disingenuous. Of course it's political. Now, there are valid reasons for it, but it's also political. And I think one of the clues is that two-thirds of the Republicans serving on it are people who are in very tough re-election battles, and nothing would be greater for them than to have a stage where they can trash Mike Madigan. And for Republicans, the ultimate would be Madigan appearing before the committee and pleading the Fifth Amendment. Now, on the flip side, Welch argues that, well, let's wait and we'll do this after the election, so all of this potential opposition research won't be available to Republicans when they're facing the voters. I guess they're facing the voters now because of early voting. And he also has asked for, let's get information about what ComEd has done with relation to other legislative leaders. Now, that's obviously a stalling tactic, but again, it makes sense in an objective way, because anybody who's watched the legislature knows that ComEd has tentacles throughout. It's not just with Democrats. It's not just in the House. It's with Republicans as well, and it's in the House and the Senate. And as a matter of fact, the two bills or laws, they became law, that the U.S. District Attorney cited specifically in the deferred prosecution agreement, on one of them, Madigan didn't even vote for it on third reading, whereas Representative Durkin did in a majority of the legislature. And one of the bills was signed into law by former Governor Bruce Rauner. So it's not a clear-cut picture of total sleaze all on behalf of Madigan. And I would be willing to bet that the U.S. attorney is not going to be able to play any tapes of Mike Madigan saying, I got this thing and it's freaking golden.
Mm-hmm. Well, A.D., well, Republicans may not get Madigan up on a, you know, I guess not on the stand, but at a table and testifying or even taking the fifth in this situation. Have they gained something by at least making this issue bigger, by having this special investigative committee? And maybe to some people it looks like Democrats may be stonewalling a bit?
I think absolutely. I mean, anything to keep Madigan's name in the news, making him continue to seem evasive, bringing up every little item in the deferred prosecution agreement that makes him look corrupt in some way. The entire campaign this season is Madigan and taxes. So anything that keeps his name in the press is good for them.
Let me move on to a different topic that also has garnered quite a bit of attention this week. The Illinois Policy Institute, it's a libertarian-leaning group, a think tank it likes to call itself, going to court to stop the graduated income tax amendment, claiming that the language on the ballot misleads voters. AD, what do they say is wrong here?
So basically they say it is misleading, unfair, kind of cheerleading language in the summary on people's ballots of what the tax would do. And they're asking for corrective notices to be sent out to voters' homes and distributed at ballot boxes. IPI is, of course, very opposed to this tax. They've been attacking it from several angles on their website. And this is a very late in the game play. This language was first forwarded from the General Assembly to the Secretary of State and the Board of Elections back in May, but they are just filing it this week as folks are starting to receive their ballots, as folks are starting to go to the polls. And it would be a pretty big undertaking for the Secretary of State to mail everything out again. But what it does effectively is bring a ton of attention to the language of this and kind of create a big sense of confusion and a big battle that kind of played out all week between this and what happened with Mike Frerich's press conference earlier this week.
Yeah, Hannah, why don't you tell us more about the treasurer, Mike Frerichs, because, again, the state treasurer doesn't always make a lot of news, and especially maybe on issues like this, but sure enough, his name is getting a lot of attention. What's happened there, and why is he in the spotlight?
Right. So Frerichs, who is a Democrat, he, back in June, he appeared at an event, I believe it was up in the suburbs, and he said, quote, one thing a progressive tax would do is make clear that you can have graduated rates when you are taxing retirement income. And I think that's something worth, that's worth discussion. You know, taxing retirement income in Illinois is kind of a third rail. Like, you just don't touch it. It's very unpopular. I was reminded earlier that actually during the 2018 gubernatorial primary, it was Governor Pritzker who kind of slammed two of his opponents who openly said, you know, they would be interested in tax and retirement income. I think I can count on one hand the number of people who I know have endorsed it, and that includes you, Charlie. It's just, it's not very popular. And so, you know, the he made this comment in June. There was a little bit of flap then, but I think the IPI and other opponents to the tax change, you know, they waited until now. Like AD said, it was a strategic move, I think, to release, you know, to file this lawsuit now and release a bunch of, you know, ads that are, you know, effectively scaring senior citizens into thinking that a vote for the graduated income tax is a vote for retirement income.
Charlie, Charlie, I guess you're the only senior citizen, at least technically, on the panel at this point, although I'm getting awfully close. So your thoughts on this? I mean, is it something to be worried about, something that seniors should be worried about?
No, I would be more worried about the asteroid hitting the Earth. And as I say, I have a personal interest in it because I am a senior citizen. Not only that, I collect Social Security and I collect the state university retirement pension. So I'm a real offender against those people who argue that we should be taxing retirement income, particularly people who are on the public dole, so to speak. The irony in all this, of course, and I think I mentioned this before, is that one of the big opponents of the constitutional amendment is the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago, which is composed of economic movers and shakers in Cook County. Last year, they proposed a budget package that included, among other things, raising the individual income tax by 20% from 4.95 to 5.95 and taxing retirement income. So I think this is very much a red herring, so to speak, and it's anything to scare seniors because, as we all know, seniors are kind of befuddled and they're addle-minded, and so if we can scare them into voting no, it'll be better for us with our the wealth that we're trying to hide.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and A.D. Quigg of Crane's Chicago Business. I want to stay on this topic for a couple of more minutes here. A.D., you wrote a story about what some other states who have gone through this, who have actually gone from a flat to a graduated income tax, and what happened there. What did you learn?
This was actually a story about states that raised rates on top incomes. So basically, my assignment for my editor was see if there was a millionaire flight after some other states raised top rates. And this is hard to figure out because people come and go all the time. They leave states for different reasons. In general, there's not, in general, when they raise taxes on these top brackets, there's not this big out-migration. There's not a mass exodus of millionaires fleeing to no tax states. And there's reason to believe Illinois will get a lot of income from this. New Jersey, when they raised rates on top earners, actually gained a lot of millionaires in spite of it. But that was because a lot of people's income went up and brought them into that top bracket. So the state is counting on $2.6 billion from that top bracket overall. I spoke to a lot of people consider the authority on millionaire migration. His name's Cristobal Young. He said, you know, based on his calculations of migration around the country, Illinois should expect to lose about 120 millionaires. How much tax revenue they take with them would vary depending on what they earn. But if we're using the state's average 2016 millionaire, that would mean a loss of about $29 million in tax revenue. So what is more interesting and maybe more worrisome for Illinois is some evidence out of California, where there were some people who engaged in tax avoidance to stay out of that top tax bracket. And we have a lot of folks in that $1 to $5 million or so bracket here. So I'll be interested to see if, you know, folks either engage in less productive activity or some other kind of legal tax avoidance to stay out of that tippy top bracket that would get hit the most under the graduated income tax.
Charlie, let me go back to you on this, because you followed this for years, this discussion of whether or not the state should have a graduated tax. Do you see some concerns there of people being able to somehow basically avoid paying that higher tax, even if it's in place?
Obviously that's, and part of it is because for people above a certain level, well, let me rephrase that. Part of the concern is that for average taxpayers, like all of us, our first dollar is taxed at a certain rate. Above a certain level, the additional dollars add are another rate, and so on. But for the very wealthiest individuals, all the dollars would be taxed at the highest rate. So that's a tremendous incentive for someone to, and you have the resources, if you're at that income level, you can hire a team of accountants to go over things with a fine-tooth comb and figure out, well, you can take this deduction, or you can turn this this gain into a loss by monkeying around with these depreciation credits. I mean, it's possible for people who are very wealthy to wind up paying only $750 a year in income tax. And so you would see the same thing at work here in Illinois, just to get them below the level. And I guess you could be below by $100, and instead of being taxed all your wealth, you'll only be taxed that portion above the cutoff.
Also, AD, did you notice anything in your research about the fact that here we are in a pandemic, economy has really slumped? You do expect people who have more money in many cases to start businesses or to invest more heavily in the economy. Would that be impacted by this? Is there some concern there too?
Well, one interesting finding that didn't really occur to me until I started going through these studies is that, yes, millionaires and super wealthy people have the ability to pick up and go, but what makes them successful business people is lifestyle and the people that you know in the place that your business is. So like place-specific social capital. Millionaires are more likely to be married to someone else who has a job. They have school-age children. They own their homes. They have these social and business connections and accumulated local market knowledge that's hard to leave behind. And the other part that interests me is how much richer the rich have gotten during the pandemic. We've seen all this reporting about how much money Jeff Bezos has made off the pandemic and off of the stock market, essentially. So I would love to see if the state, how much the state has changed its assumptions on how much money they will make. I know they tweaked it slightly, but are still expecting to make the same amount in that first half year if this thing does pass, so between January and the end of the fiscal year. But long term, I wonder what the long term impacts of the recession might be and how much that impacts the revenues they're counting on.
Well, let's move on to another announcement that took place this week. Governor J.B. Pritzker, and Hannah, you were covering him. He made an announcement regarding some criminal justice reforms that he wants to see approved. Give us the lowdown on that.
That's right. You know, the governor has, it was early this year, I believe in January, he released, I think he had a press conference and he said, these are my criminal justice reform priorities. And then the pandemic hit. And obviously it's been hard to concentrate on much aside from that, especially given that he spent a lot of time, you know, campaigning and pushing for his graduated income tax, because that was his signature campaign promise. But, you know, this was also a promise, and especially after a summer of protests, you know, in reaction to the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis and Jacob Blake in Kenosha. There's been tremendous pressure on the governor's office to get going on some of these other promises. And so he and the Black Caucus have been negotiating for months. And, you know, he came out with this 7-part plan. It includes licensing police officers that got attention, I think, in the spring. Attorney General Kwame Raoul had also expressed support for this. Ending cash bail, which is something that folks had already been working on. Decriminalizing minor nonviolent offenses. And then also, you know, finding other ways to reduce the population in the Department of Corrections, which was something that, former Governor Bruce Rauner also had as a goal. And I think during his time, I believe he was able to reduce the number a little bit. It's something that, this area of policy is something that has also attracted conservatives in the last, I would say, decade. And it's something that, Rauner, of course, he counted as a bipartisan win. It's not like he had many, but, it's something that you can reach across the aisle and really move the needle on. Licensing police officers might be a little harder. Some of the other more progressive things that the governor has on his plate might be a tougher sell, but it's not like they have to have Republican buy-in for everything. There are super majorities in the House and Senate. The Black Caucus is very powerful in both the chambers, and I think they'll probably be able to get it across the finish line. And from what senators told me this week, and the governor said himself, they want to get this done in veto session in November.
Yeah, Charlie, this is, as you made a good point there, this is, even some of these issues have attracted conservatives as well, who feel that maybe, some civil liberties have been trampled on and some changes need to be made. Do you see any real problems with all the things in this package?
Oh, I think there was some opposition to some of them, but I think what it reflects is kind of a shifting of the pendulum. For many years, the idea in Illinois was lock them up and throw the key away. And so for session after session, lawmakers would increase penalties and enhance offenses. And it got to be where probably the fastest growing industry in Illinois was building prisons. Now the pendulum, as they say, has shifted, and part of it is that people who are progressives who are interested in social justice notice that we disproportionately lock up poor people, we disproportionately lock up people of color, and on the other side, conservatives are saying, hey, we're spending a ton of money on this stuff, and what are we getting for it? Half the people that we imprison, and we let them go, and within 3 years, they're back there at our doorstep. What the heck is this? And so this is maybe a good time. Governor Rauner started working in this area. Governor Pritzker is following. And some of the things just make common sense. The agency that oversees our correction, well, it's the Department of Corrections, not the Department of Punishment. And so the idea is that we should correct people. We should have more rehabilitation. And that was one of the first things that the governor talked about. Provide pathways for people to earn opportunities for when they are out of the system to not return. So things like education, teaching people a trade, doing away with the cash bail system, which disproportionately affects poor people who can't come up with the cash bail, so they sit in a county jail forever and a day waiting for a hearing, using more, I guess you would call them social services, things like mental health and addiction treatment to help keep people out of the system in the first place and prepare them to function on the outside. None of this stuff is rocket science. I mean, the evidence and the studies have shown that if you lock somebody up and don't do anything other than feed him and then let him go, he's not necessarily going to be a better person, probably much the worse. On the other hand, if you provide him mental health counseling, drug abuse treatment, teach him a skill, maybe get him his high school degree, let him go, there's a chance, a much better chance, that he'll succeed on the outside.
Just about a minute left here, and AD, I'm going to go to you on this. We've been following the COVID numbers and, you know, still concerns out there in the state of Illinois, some successes, some not so much. I wanted to get your view from Chicago. The mayor there has been concerned about some neighboring states, Wisconsin, Indiana. Real quick, give us sort of the update on what's happening there when it comes to COVID-19.
So Chicago is very close to logging 3,000 deaths alone. We've had plateauing cases basically since June with a slight rise. But the mayor is very worried about the impact of cases in Wisconsin. If you look at their COVID cases, it went up exponentially. There are travel restrictions from both Wisconsin and Indiana. And this comes at a fearful time, not just because flu season is starting, but because we're close to making a decision about whether Chicago Public Schools will welcome kids back in person. So there's plenty of concern here about the path, and we haven't made a meaningful drop in cases like the city wanted to see months ago. We're still hovering around 300 cases a day, which is still a high incidence state. So there's plenty to worry about here.
All right, well, let's go to our notes from the field. Hannah, we'll start with you.
Right. Republican House member Brad Helbrook, he is from Southeast Illinois, I believe. He's in a very safe Republican district, but I thought it was very interesting this week that his daughter, Ashley, who seems to be in her late 20s, early 30s, she actually cut an ad for her father's opponent saying that, you know, her father is bad for the state. And I thought that was a very, very interesting move. We see that from time to time, but it's always a little shocking.
Okay, AD?
So the city of Chicago is facing off at the U.S. Supreme Court next week against an interesting coalition of opponents, including the Cato Institute and the ACLU over its car impoundment policy. This has been a hot topic for several years. The city relies pretty heavily on fines and fees from parking and ticketing violations. Basically, even after folks declare bankruptcy, the city keeps hold of impounded cars by claiming liens so they could get some money back. Folks with the cars impounded argue they need those back so they can start making money and restart their lives. I'm very interested to see how this plays out and how it impacts Chicago's super heavy reliance on fines and fees, even though they've made some reforms here.
All right. And Charlie?
Well, on the economic front, the sale of marijuana, recreational marijuana in Illinois, continues to grow each month. The Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation reported another month of record sales in September, a grand total of $67.6 million from selling more than 1.4 million items. On the other hand, the money that we've been realizing over the years from gaming really went down in the last fiscal year that ended June 30th, fell from $1.4 billion to $1.2 billion, a decline of more than 13%, according to the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and A.D. Quigg with Crane Chicago Business. Get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. Production assistance for the program was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.